This is Free Speech Radio News for Wednesday, the 1st of June, 2005. From KPFK in LA, I'm Aura Bogado. Activists converge in Washington to protest new World Bank President Paul Wolfowitz. A grassroots effort is launched to impeach George Bush over the Downing Street memos. And as insurgent attacks in Iraq continue, we'll take a look at unreported violence. These stories and more after these headlines.
I'm Randy Zimmerman with the headlines for Free Speech Radio News. People in the Netherlands are voting today on whether to support the European Union Constitution. Only the parliament may actually approve or reject adoption of the document. However, most political parties pledged to vote along with the majority of today's Dutch voters, as long as 30% of the population goes to the polls. Political leaders in Palestine are trying to quell a disagreement between two major parties and are delaying a scheduled revote. Manar Jabrin explains from the International Middle East Media Center.
The local elections committee decided to put off for 1 month the revote at 51 polling stations in elections set for today. The decision followed a request made by Fatah officials in a bid to defuse tension between Hamas and Fatah. The revote was scheduled based on court ruling that cancelled results in some polling stations, claiming that irregularities were found during the original vote, which Hamas won. Sheikh Hassan Youssef of Hamas said it is important to have fair elections.
All factions agreed on the delay in a meeting in Gaza. What is important now is to ensure that the revote will be held fairly by examining the voter registrar and by forming technical committees which will hold the revote and count the ballots.
Hamas still insists on holding the parliamentary elections on July 17, despite reports that they have agreed to delay them until after the Israeli pullout from the Gaza Strip. For Free Speech Radio News from the International Middle East Media Center in Palestine, this is Manar Jibrin.
The United Nations Security Council extended the mandate for another 24 days of the so-called peacekeeping force in Haiti as violence erupted in the nation's capital. Reed Lindsay has more from Port-au-Prince.
United Nations Secretary General Kofi Annan had asked the Security Council to extend the mandate for 1 year. The 24-day extension for UN peacekeepers in Haiti appeared to be a compromise to buy the UN time to work out objections raised by China. The UN peacekeeping force, which was established 1 year ago today, has come under intense scrutiny in recent weeks. Hardliners in the government and the tiny Haitian elite have demanded more assistance in cracking down on kidnappings and other crime. Human rights groups have criticized the UN for shooting civilians and providing backup to the Haitian police officers who commit rights abuses. On Tuesday, the honorary French consul in the northern city of Cap-Haitien was shot dead by unidentified gunmen, and heavy gunfire was heard throughout the day in the poor neighborhoods of Port-au-Prince. The ongoing violence presents a bleak scenario for three rounds of elections beginning in October. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Reed Lindsay from Port-au-Prince, Haiti.
The first register of genetically modified contamination incidents has been created. Naomi Fowler has more from London.
Since GM crops were introduced in 1996, there have been more than 60 incidents of illegal or unlabeled contamination documented in 27 countries. Today, the world's governments are talking about developing rules to allow all GM products to be traced. So if they are accidentally or deliberately released into the environment, the extent of the contamination among non-GM plants or animals can be tracked. GeneWatch UK and Greenpeace say that must be accompanied by strict rules that force companies to take responsibility and pay if their GM products are found to contaminate the environment or the food supply. But progress has been slow on the subject of liability, with strong opposition from the United States and the large agribusinesses that market GM products. This is Naomi Fowler in London for Free Speech Radio News.
Day laborers in D.C. started organizing this morning before the sun came up to fight together against what they call dire conditions. From the D.C. Radio Co-op, Tom Gomez reports.
Day laborers, focusing on their most basic economic human rights, showed up at 5 a.m. today before the Labor Ready offices opened here in Washington, D.C. The workers are trying to organize others like them, who every morning line up hoping for a day of work at minimum wage with Labor Ready, one of the nation's largest employers. Both Jamie Morby and Jesse Schultz work regularly for the company.
We were assigned to a job. We drove all the way out to the job site. We started, and then they decided they'd brought too many people and sent us home without any type of compensation.
So we decided to use a little bit of our internal anger and strike while the iron was hot.
Almost all the men outside the Labor Ready office today signed a petition demanding better conditions. Many of them called for a meeting to establish an organizing committee. The manager of the Rhode Island Avenue Labor Ready office, identified as Anthony Peterson, refused to comment. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Tom Gomez of the DC Radio Co-op.
And I'm Randy Zimmerman for Free Speech Radio News.
President Bush told reporters today that he was caught by surprise that the former number two official at the FBI, Mark Felt, was Watergate's deep throat, who leaked information to the Washington Post, which led to Richard Nixon's resignation. Bush said he's anxious to learn more details about Felt's relationship to the media, and that it's hard for a president to judge whether Felt provided a valuable public service or acted improperly. Meanwhile, the grassroots effort to impeach George Bush over the Downing Street memos has been launched. Memos leaked from the British government indicate that Prime Minister Tony Blair and President Bush conspired to invade Iraq before their intention was made public. Mitch Jezerich has more.
Today, President Bush said he was interested in learning more about former Deputy Director of the FBI, Mark Felt's relationship to the news media. Felt has recently confessed as being Deep Throat, the man who leaked information that led to the demise of the Nixon administration. Bush said he hasn't decided whether what Felt did was appropriate or not. Defense Secretary Donald Rumsfeld, who was a former Nixon appointee during Watergate, was asked today during a press conference his views of Deep Throat.
Anytime wrongdoing occurs, it's important that that wrongdoing be reported. And I think that's appropriate. Now, who one reports that to, the authorities is one thing, or somebody else is another. But I'm not knowledgeable enough to be in a position to judge it.
Rumsfeld opened up his press conference by slamming the news media for what he says has not covered the detainee issue in a proper context. There have been numerous leaks within the Bush administration on detainee abuse and other issues, including the Bush administration's justification for war. Norman Solomon, director of the Institute on Public Accuracy and author of the upcoming book War Made Easy, compared the Deep Throat phenomena to recently leaked British documents known as the Downing Street memos that suggest Bush planned on invading Iraq long before the intention was made public.
The resistance of the mass media in 72, 73 was quite distinct. I mean, these were major stories being treated as trivialities. And I think that we've got a parallel here where at a time of war, evidence has emerged of very significant presidential deception. And now in June of 2005, we're having a lot of trouble getting the U.S. mass media to deal with this Downing Street memo.
The Downing Street memo also indicates that top British officials found Bush's claim that Iraq possessed weapons of mass destruction as weak. The British government has not denied the accuracy of the memos. Francis Boyle, professor of law at the University of Illinois and who heads a grassroots organization calling on the impeachment of Bush, says the memos present sufficient legal evidence for Congress to begin impeachment proceedings.
We have official confirmation of that argument that the allegations about weapons of mass destruction were lies, they were a pretext. And legally, constitutionally, why this is important then is that the Constitution gives to Congress the right and the power to declare war. And in order to procure Congress's authorization to use military force against Iraq, President Bush Jr. clearly lied to Congress.
Boyle and former Attorney General Ramsey Clark, who heads another organization calling for the impeachment of the president, says together that they have gathered over 500,000 signatures online for a petition calling for impeachment proceedings to begin. Such an act would have to start in the House Judiciary Committee. Ranking Democrat on the committee, John Conyers of Detroit, has already petitioned the president to explain what he knows about the Downing Street memos. The president has yet to respond. A congressional source says that Conyers is now weighing his options on how to proceed.
We have to convince Congressman Conyers.
Again, Francis Boyle.
And several House Democrats and the independent Bernie Sanders, whom I've tried to convince to do this, to put bills of impeachment in. And the way we are going to do this is to demonstrate a broad support among public opinion for impeachment.
Mitch Jezerich, Free Speech Radio News.
The situation in Iraq is growing increasingly violent, with 77 U.S. soldiers and 600 Iraqis killed last month. An average of 70 attacks occur per day throughout the country, and the month of May has been one of the bloodiest thus far. The U.S. military admitted today that a suicide bomber attacked the main checkpoint to Baghdad International Airport, wounding approximately 15 Iraqis. This latest incident is just one among many acts of violence in the war in Iraq, but with a lack of journalists on the ground, many go unreported. Eric Klein has more.
Issam Rashid is an Iraqi journalist working in Baghdad. He says that before the invasion, it wasn't easy to work as a journalist under Saddam Hussein's regime. But now with the war, being a reporter is even more dangerous.
But now it's worse because I know, because they arrested me two times from the road because I filmed at that time, I shot some for attack.
Under the U.S. occupation, Issam has been detained twice by American troops while filming the aftermaths of attacks on U.S. forces by Iraqi fighters.
And they take the tape and they let us to go. They release us after, or they keep us for 6 hours or 5 hours after to threaten us to don't shoot this kind of film again. They want to hide something.
According to the Committee to Protect Journalists, 43 journalists have been killed while covering the conflict in Iraq. 18 of them, journalists from the international media, and 9 confirmed killed by American forces. Mark Manning is an independent filmmaker whose documentary, Road to Fallujah, comes out next fall. Manning was in Fallujah filming in January, but he doesn't like to call himself a journalist.
Boy, that's a term that I don't even respect anymore after Iraq. So, no, I consider myself an independent filmmaker. But, I have a hard time with that word now because there's no real truth coming out of Iraq from all the embedded journalists there.
Manning was in Fallujah to document civilian life in the city after the last siege by the U.S. and Iraqi forces.
It's a very hostile environment for unembedded journalists. I heard a lot of stories about journalists having their cameras confiscated and taken. So I went in with that in mind, as that's just what's going to be the case, and completely filmed undercover. So I didn't really pull my camera out a lot unless I felt that I was out of the eyeballs of both the American military and really more importantly the Iraqi National Guard. Now, those people were considered very dangerous to have a camera around. A couple of times they did see me filming. We were detained once, and they pointed their weapons at us as soon as they saw us with cameras, and it was a matter of, you know, putting the camera down and running and not trying to figure out whether or not they were going to shoot. It seemed like that was going to be their intention. So the whole feeling there is that you are not allowed to film.
According to Manning, the U.S. forces and the Iraqi National Guard have legitimate concerns for their safety regarding being filmed, because everyone is their enemy. But, he adds, there may be another reason for restricting coverage.
It's very important for the policymakers not to have the truth about what's happening to the civilian populations in combat areas getting back to the American people, because I strongly feel that if the American people saw the suffering on the mass scale to the civilians in Iraq during these military operations, that they would wholeheartedly not support it.
For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Eric Klein.
A campaign is now underway in India to garner support for the fundamental right for the country's residents to be free from hunger and malnutrition. While a bill called the Employment Guarantee Plan is under consideration in the Indian Parliament, the country's poor continue to starve while government warehouses overflow with grains. FSRN correspondent Binu Alex reports from Panch Mahal's one of the poorest districts in western India.
Currently, in India, An informal network of organizations and individuals have launched a countrywide Rojgar Adhikar Yatra, or Right to Work Convoy, to raise awareness to repercussions of the Employment Guarantee Act. The aim of this two-month convoy is to consolidate the campaign for a full-fledged, universal and irreversible Employment Guarantee Act. John Trees is a professor at the Delhi School of Economics and a member of the support group of the Right to Food campaign.
So the purpose of this Yatra is to consolidate the public demand for this Employment Guarantee Act, which is potentially very big. But one reason why it doesn't come through is that many people don't really know what the Employment Guarantee Act is about and why it's so important. So basically we're going around the country and trying to give people an opportunity to learn about this issue, to discuss it and to organize around it.
70% of India's population live in rural areas, and 40% of the population is classified as poor. The basic idea of the Employment Guarantee Act, when tabled in the Parliament in December 2004, was to give a legal guarantee of employment to anyone who is willing to do casual manual labour at the statutory minimum wage. Government efforts to provide economic security for Indian citizens have failed in the past. Activists cite this as the reason a law is mandatory and not schemes. Santoshivan Chowdhury is from Panchmahal district in Gujarat, and she says the condition of the people in her village is pathetic.
This year we are completely without work. Today people are not getting a single meal to eat, and if we get work here, we can stay here in our home without having to migrate to far-flung places.
The ruling UPA government, headed by the Congress, introduced a common minimum program, which was primarily responsible for its unexpected victory in the last general election and a year ago. The pledge in the manifesto promises to immediately enact a National Employment Guarantee Act. The act, if enacted, will not only prove to be a major source of empowerment for women, but will also protect rural households from poverty and hunger. However, no concrete step has been taken. According to Shankar Singh, a social activist, political will is the only solution to passing the act.
If you are working at one place, you will think differently, will question the government in power, and then will unite. So to keep the poor laborers at different places is a political ploy. And mind you, any government in power is always pro-rich.
India does not enforce a uniform minimum wage. Some organized laborers get rupees equivalent to more than $4 a day, while in some areas it is as low as 50 cents. If work is available in the village, many families will stay instead of heading for the cities. Due to lack of employment opportunities, many are migrating to urban areas, which makes matter worse. From Godhra in Western India, I'm Binu Alex for Free Speech Radio News.
A proposal by the Boulder City Council in Colorado to develop a waste treatment plant on an area sacred to Native Americans has brought together a coalition of protesters to oppose the plan. Residents gathered last night at City Council offices where a study session on the development was taking place. Maeve Conran has more.
After considering 14 other sites, Boulder City Council are nearing a decision to build a waste treatment facility and a fire training centre on Valmont Butte in Boulder County. The city's plans to develop in this area has angered a wide range of groups, from environmentalists to local historians, and particularly Native Americans.
Basically, I'm speaking out for this sacred butte from the standpoint of our spirituality, as far as tribal people who used to live here throughout the thousands of years. And there have been burial sites up at Valmont Butte for thousands of years.
Nick Halsey of the Lakota Nation explained that as well as being the site for ancient burial grounds, there is a functioning sweat lodge in the area which is still used in Native American ceremonies. The city's plans to put a human waste treatment facility in the area would be desecration of sacred lands and the destruction of Native American history.
The Arapaho spiritual elders spoke out and said that yes, there are burial grounds there. It is a sacred area of prayer, and we need to preserve this area for all people because we basically are destroying areas all over the place through development.
Valmont Butte is an area of approximately 130 acres. As well as Native American burial sites, there is a pioneer cemetery in the area, and local historians fear it will be disturbed should the development plans go ahead. The Butte is also host to a diverse range of wildlife, including birds of prey. Any development on the area would disrupt their habitat. Stephen Simich is part of a committee working to preserve the Butte.
We're against any development there, and partly because of the different issues there, but also the wildlife that exists there, the native species that are growing there, plants, as well as the raptors, the animals that are on that area. We feel with the fire department and their activities out there, it'll be very noisy and disruptive.
Local organic farmers are outraged at the proposals for the biowaste site. USDA regulations do not allow certified organic farmers to apply any biosolid products to their lands due to high levels of heavy metals and nitrogen. Farmers are concerned that possible leaks from the biowaste facility could jeopardize their organic status. An increasing number of protesters are asking the city to consider alternate sites. However, the city will make its final decision August 16th. For FSRN, this is Maeve Conran in Boulder, Colorado.
According to a new report issued by Mexico's Labor Research and Union Consulting Center, up to 2,500 workers in that country lose their jobs daily due to closing factories and low sales. The report adds that older workers are now more likely to take low-wage jobs with poor working conditions that demand they work longer than 8 hours, typically in multinational factories. Meanwhile, in Washington, a coalition of civil society groups held a demonstration outside World Bank headquarters to protest its new president, Paul Wolfowitz. The activists are seeking to reform World Bank policies and attempted to deliver a letter naming issues and demands. Jenny Johnson reports.
Open the meetings, cancel the debt, end structural adjustment.
Representatives of civil society who were out in front of the World Bank today to denounce the previous Deputy Secretary of Defense on his first day as president do not expect major policy shifts for the better or worse in their view. However, they oppose the appointment of the new president nonetheless. Basiv Sen is with the Mobilization for Global Justice.
Paul Wolfowitz symbolizes everything that is the worst in the World Bank and in U.S. foreign policy. He combines U.S. military adventurism abroad and U.S. foreign economic policy, which imposes a one-size-fits-all so-called free market model on poor countries.
Over 300 organizations in 60 countries endorsed a letter that set demands, some in relation to Wolfowitz's role in Iraq policy while at the Pentagon, namely that he allow independent investigations, continue food subsidies to Iraq, and extend debt relief to other nations as he had suggested happen for Iraq. When the activists attempted to deliver the letter, they were not allowed in the door.
We could not enter. Yet again, we repeat, one of the demands is for people, ordinary people as ourselves, to be able to enter institutions that say they stand in support of people, in support particularly of poor people. So we tried to enter the doors, and we were told we could not enter.
Around the world, in the Global South, actions are going on as we speak. So this is not the only place this is happening. This may not be the only place that we're being denied access to key policymakers, and the struggle continues.
Amira Woods is with the Institute for Policy Studies, and Samir Sozani is the director of the 50 Years is Enough Network. These international groups were surprised and disappointed by the lack of opposition to the Bush administration's nominee for World Bank president. Basiv Sen explains.
The spinelessness of people like the French and the German governments who made big noises about opposing the war on Iraq 2 years ago. But today, when it comes to advancing the agenda of French and German business, such as French water privatization companies like Suez. They will stand by the Bush administration because really they all have common interests in the exploitation of the Global South.
Jenny Johnson, Free Speech Radio News.
The Air Force Academy conducted a survey in 2004 of its faculty and staff, which showed that there were religious respect issues that were being ignored. In summer of that year, the Academy conducted focus groups with graduate students who also expressed concerns about religious tolerance. The Academy then interviewed cadets when they returned in the fall. In over 2 months, they received 55 reports of incidents of religious discrimination, which occurred over the last 4 years, from 2000 to 2005. In Colorado Springs, Maria Cecilia Callier has more.
After looking at data collected last year, the Air Force Academy admitted that it had a religious tolerance issue. Lieutenant Colonel Laurent Fox, Director of Public Affairs at the Air Force Academy, said individual incidents had, up to that time, gone unreported.
The people did not report it up the chain of command like they should have. They just shrugged it off or just were upset or kept it inside. And so we couldn't really do anything when they happened at the time. But we asked them exactly what happened, and you'd have somebody who's a senior cadet say, when I was a freshman 4 years ago, this happened. And they were religious slurs. They were people, faculty, that were probably proselytizing a little too much, going over the line. So what we decided back in fall of 2004 was to build a training program that's going to help educate people on respect. And we found that the real problem was respect of others' beliefs. So we went ahead and started building this course, and it's called Respect for the Values of All People, or RSVP.
Lieutenant Colonel Vicky Rass, Chief of the Climate and Culture Division for the Superintendent at the Air Force Academy, said the purpose of the first phase of the RSVP program is to try to raise the awareness regarding the nature of religious intolerance issues at the Air Force Academy and society at large.
We have to keep in mind that we've got 18 through 22-year-olds here who are trying to find their way and sometimes succumb to peer pressure and don't have either the understanding or the wherewithal to stand up and say, you know, I'm not quite sure, but that doesn't feel right. Let's talk about it. We're hoping that by giving them, if you will, the rules of the road, putting up the guardrails so they'll know how the Establishment Clause and free speech of the Constitution interact, along with the DOD directives and Air Force instructions, that they'll understand the purpose and the ways in which acting appropriately or inappropriately affect mission success and unit cohesion.
As the allegations of racial intolerance began to surface at the Academy, Americans United for Separation of Church and State began to take notice. AU advocates religious liberty for all, guaranteed by the U.S. Constitution, which separates church and state. AU objects to Christianity being touted over any other belief shared by a minority of cadets at the Academy. In the meantime, the Pentagon has set up a task force to investigate the allegations of religious discrimination at the Air Force Academy. Stephen Sands, a member of AU in Colorado, said his group will be a watchdog.
What we're going to do is we're going to oversee the investigation, and we are going to monitor what the Air Force Academy is doing about this, and we're going to speak to witnesses and people who were involved in getting attacked or being discriminated against. We will work with our attorneys at Americans United and see what our options are. We may even sue the Air Force Academy.
In Colorado Springs, Colorado, I'm Maria Cecile Collier for Free Speech Radio News.
Free Speech Radio News is produced at Pacifica Stations WBAI in New York, KPFK in Los Angeles, and KPFA in Berkeley, and community radio station WMNF in Tampa, Florida. The newscast is produced by Monica Lopez and Simba Russo. Headlines editors are Randy Zimmerman and Nell Abram. Our technical production team is Jade Paget-Seekins, Pauline Bartolone, Mick Millen, and Eric Klein. In Los Angeles, I'm Aura Bogado.